On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
Welcome to On the Bookshelf. We're extending our celebration of Independence Day to this weekend because I had the wonderful opportunity to interview Rick Herrera, who's written a book entitled Feeding Washington's Army, Surviving the Valley Forge Winter of 1778 from the University of North Carolina Press. It was so interesting. I called him and he's in between jobs. I mean, this interview is taking place as he's getting finished with one career as a professor at of military history at the School of Advanced Military Studies at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. And he's moving to the Army War College, and he will start there by the time this interview airs. So we're delighted to welcome Ricardo Rick Herrera today to On the Bookshelf.
No, thank you. Thank you. And actually, Valley Forge weather was really erratic. It swang. You could have snow one day, rain the next, frozen mud, good mud, deep mud. Good. I don't know if I'd call it good. And so it was just all over the place. Some days the snow was deep enough that you could ride sleighs in Philadelphia. Other days, forget it. But in terms of the cold, Morristown winters were actually far worse than Valley Forge.
That's what I've learned. It seems to me that we have this for people, and hopefully they still teach this in American history in high schools. It's been a long time since I've been in high school, but I remember reading about the soldiers huddled around the fires and inadequate shelter, inadequate clothing, inadequate food always, and how every winter it seemed to be the same thing. And growing up in Florida, this is a really alien concept to me, the idea that winter would last from October to May or something. For us, winter is about 2 weeks in January.
I'm actually from Los Angeles, so winter? What is this thing?
Right. Amazing that they deliberately did this, but there were good reasons for them. This enabled them to keep the army coalesced, right?
By maintaining a position where they were, so either Valley Forge or Morristown, what Washington was purposefully doing was keeping the army close enough to respond to the British should their armies move out of Philadelphia or New York. But he was also in great defensible ground. And so Morristown, you've got the Watchung Mountains, and you don't want to attack up those. It's nasty stuff. And so Washington's got a great position. If you think about Valley Forge, one of the things that I introduced in the book is, let's think about it in terms of something that many of us have heard about over the past 20 years, and that's the Forward Operating Base, or the FOB.
Right.
And so think about Valley Forge as FOB Valley Forge.
It makes a lot more sense when you think of it that way. Instead of we're hiding from the British, which is kind of the old paradigm, it's a lot smarter and more strategic, because Washington was quite a good strategic general, wasn't he? He knew.
He was.
He knew he couldn't win the big battles.
Washington develops over time and he becomes a really, I think, formidable strategist. In fact, I think he far outclasses most of his British opponents. He's at times myopic. You know, he's got this fixation with New York, which is the first major British seizure of the war. Mm-hmm. And the Brits hang on to it until the end of the war. And so in 1781, what eventually leads up to Yorktown, the French kind of force him, very politely, mind you, and very, they're very diplomatic about it, but they force Washington to reconsider his fixation on New York and get him to go to Yorktown, where the Franco-American army, the Allied army, is able to bag Cornwallis's army. But yeah, he develops, for the British, his opponent for most of the war, General Sir William Howe. Howe is a great tactical commander, and he outclasses Washington every time they face each other. And that's fine, because winning a bunch of battles, while that's really nice, okay, and I don't mean to downplay sacrifice or any of that, but if you don't have the right strategy, it doesn't matter how many battles you win. If your strategy is poor, you're not going to win a thing. And so Hal really needs something that he had called for very early on in his tenure of command, something like a viceroy, somebody who could actually coordinate all of Britain's efforts in America. The closest thing they've got is Lord George Germain, who's the colonial secretary, but he's in Whitehall. He's back in London, and he's unable to exercise any close control over Hal.
And wasn't there a feeling that since this was a British colony, that they would come over here and everybody would be delighted to see them and eager to get rid of the rebels, and they would be glad to give them all the food and shelter and forage that they needed? And that isn't the way it turned out at all.
No, and it's, you know, these are, you know, keep in mind that, you know, these were until Britain actually says, okay, uncle, you know, we will recognize your independence. Until then, these 13 mainland colonies, and there were something like 26 or 29 total in the Western Hemisphere, the Brits are looking at this from the position of the imperial power, and so they're assuming that, yeah, that they're going, that it's only a few deluded rebels who are stirring up people, and in some measure, you know, it depends on where you are, because not everyone was for independence. You had quite a few Americans who wanted just to be left alone, stay right away from me, let me get on with my life. Others of whom were openly loyal to the crown. So it's really a mixed bag. But yeah, the British discover that it's difficult to sustain their army in the colonies, and so most of the British supplies come from mother country, although they were getting quite a few from areas in which they operated.
And this was a huge surprise for them, because they thought they could live off the land, and they're finding that to live off the land increasingly alienates the very people that they think they're serving. The only people that are really happy to see them are the people who are selling stuff to them, because they get paid in money that will actually be worth something, rather than the continental paper money, which becomes almost laughably useless early on in the war.
Oh yeah, it's really something else. For the British, they're, as you know, as you've already pointed out, yeah, there's this hope that they'll be able to sustain themselves off the countryside. It doesn't work that way. And the British Army operated by a rule of thumb that said, hey, you need to have 6 months' worth of supplies. And there are only a couple of times that the British Army ever has that during all 8 years of this war for independence.
Wow.
So they're constantly living, at least from their point of view, rather a tight existence. You're absolutely right. You know, would be happy to see them would be those who can sell and get hard cash, you know, gold or silver for their goods. But by and large, nobody wants to see an army anywhere near them, because it doesn't matter if you are supporting independence, if you're supporting loyalty, you don't want to see any soldiers near you, because they will destroy everything in their path.
Right.
And even if they're not trying to destroy it, they're going to.
Right. You get that many people and you get that many horses, everything that goes with it, it's going to tear up your crops. It's going to tear up your farm. It's just not going to be good.
Not at all.
We're talking, in case you're late joining us, to Rick Herrera, who has been the professor of military history at the School of Advanced Military Studies at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. And his new gig is going to be at the Army War College. He took time as he's transitioning from one place to another to talk to us about his new book, Feeding Washington's Army, Surviving the Valley Forge Winter of 1778. It's from the University of North Carolina Press, who has lots of wonderful books about the Revolutionary War. And you can check their website, uncpress.org, to find out more. Now, this is interesting, because everything I've read about Washington at Valley Forge and at York and at Morristown has been, well, we got to go find some food somewhere. We got to go find some clothes somewhere. So send people out. And there was always a need for it. But this particular, the Grand Forage of 1778, is not something that's particularly well known. And that's one of the things about your book that really jumped out at me, that, wow, here's a chance to learn a whole new aspect, a proactive thing that's going on with Washington, not just saying, well, we hope we'll survive, and Gasharuni, hope maybe some cows will wander by. Instead, he organizes and sends out well-equipped men to go find more food and more forage. And both of those are equally critical, aren't they?
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that most Americans grow up with, and, you know, what comes to mind about Valley Forge when you think about it? And it's passive army, it's in Valley, it's at the, in the camp, it's freezing, it's suffering, it's starving. Okay, there's a little bit of truth to that, but what we really need to do, I believe, is understand the Continental Army, the main army under Washington, and indeed any of the other armies as field armies. And so the Continentals under Washington were doing a lot of the stuff that modern-day armies do today. This is an armed encampment, and it's set up and it's prepared to defend itself. There are several lines of defensive works. It's actually a defense in depth, the way that it's set up, and it's really wonderfully done. But even outside of the camp, Washington has got outposts. So one of the key ones being manned by Captain Henry Lee, better known as Light Horse Harry Lee, who commands 5th Troop, 1st Continental Light Dragoons, and he's manning one of these posts. And like other soldiers, there are patrols, they're looking for the enemy, trying to keep a watch for them. They're also attacking enemy parties as they come across them, gathering information. All of this is the stuff that my students are familiar with, that every soldier would be familiar with. And so rather than view it as this really quaint, old-timey sort of stuff, guys in triangle hats and all that, think of them as real soldiers. They just dress differently. It's a different age, but they're doing the stuff that that your listeners, family and friends who have been in the service, that they too would recognize in many ways. And you know, when you're mentioning the fact that it was unknown or largely unknown, that is every historian's dream, to come across something that's important enough, that you think is important enough to write about, but that nobody's touched. And so there have been others who have incorporated bits and pieces of it, but this is the first book that's actually studied the Grand Forge of 1778 on its own merits. And so I'm incredibly happy for that.
In here, you bring some amazing statistics. We don't think about how much stuff it takes to keep an army going. In one place you state statistically that the Continental Army was really never much more than 17,000 men. Between December 1777 and June 78, the Army consumed 4.5 million pounds of bread, flour, and biscuit, nearly 4 million pounds of meat and fish, something over 2,272 tons of breadstuffs, and 1,985 tons of meat and fish. The numbers, painstakingly compiled by a Valley Forge historian, are estimates extracted from incomplete records. They don't have March and April. That is amazing. That doesn't count what it takes to feed the horses. You know, our modern viewpoint, we forget the fact that up until the last century, armies still used mainly horses for everything. You got to have food for horses, and horses make messes. They got to be warm, and all of these things are logistics. We don't think about that anymore, but they had to think about them in those days.
I think one of the things when my ilk writes military history, you know, the thing that tends to sell is the battles, and for lack of a better term, that's the really sexy stuff.
You
know, the armies coming and clashing, but in order to do that, you have to feed these guys. And so what I wanted to do was to emphasize, by using the story of the army going out and feeding itself, to emphasize its maturation, and particularly Washington's maturation, but their ability to actually go out and conduct some pretty sophisticated operations. And it illustrates a lot of the trust and the teamwork that Washington had established between himself and his subordinates, Nathaniel Greene, Anthony Wayne, John Barry, Henry Lee, and so many other officers, and then also their trust and faith in one another. And so it's just amazing. And so this is the story of a mature army that has learned how to do the stuff of soldiering. They make mistakes. All armies do. All armies are learning institutions back then, today, 100 years from now. And this is part of their story. It's part of our story as Americans.
Absolutely. The idea that you've got to come up with, again, a horse a day, that it needs 20 pounds of fodder and 9 pounds of oats or corn per horse per day. And then, and this is something, again, that your book brought to mind that I'd never thought about, you can't just say, okay, I need to get these things. Great, here we have them. How we get them back? You can't go to Home Depot and say, hey, do you have a couple of 300 or so wagons we could buy on credit? they had to find the wagons, they had to make the wagons, or they had to steal the wagons and get them to the places where the food was so they could then get the food or forage back to Valley Forge. It's not a simple concept at all.
Oh no! I mean, this is a constant throughout the war. There were never enough wagons to sustain the army. There are a couple of times, a handful of periods where the quartermaster general's department and the commissary general's department function not too bad, but for most of the war, these are staggeringly shambolic operations, and it's not that these purchasing agents, issuing agents, the commissary generals, the quartermaster generals, it's not that they're trying to do a bad job, it's not that they're trying to steal from anybody, it's a host of problems. The Congress was really concerned about the growth of military power, and that power would choke out and seize the people's liberty. And so they put in place these complex regulations to restrain the growth of power. That also restrained, however, efficiency. So that really worked against a lot of this. And farmers, they're not dummies. They see what's going on. They see how worthless Continental money is.
Right.
And they think, I don't want that. So it's a host of things that are working against the sustainment systems, the logistics, and who suffers? It's the soldiers.
Right.
They are the ones who bear the burden.
Always. It's always the boots on the ground, isn't it? This is also to remind folks that the British were also having to forage, and therefore they're foraging in a lot of the same places. So the soldiers, the American soldiers that go out, the Continentals, have to be wary and wise, lest they run into British foragers. Nobody wants to get into pick a battle when you're in the middle of something like this. There are times for battles, and the generals like to pick them. A skirmish over food is not going to do anybody any good. So there's always that's one of the reasons, and this was another thing that I learned from your book, that they made sure that the guys that went on the foraging party had the best gear, had sufficient munitions and everything else with them so they could go out in case they ran across a situation where they would have to defend the forage they were getting.
Sure, absolutely. And it's, you've got, and the British will send out sometimes upwards half of their army to go out on these expeditions. And it's just amazing. And so think of the British anyway as perhaps as these red-coated, or in the case of the German auxiliaries, we know them better as Hessians, as blue-coated locusts, just devouring and gathering up everything in their paths. The Continentals doing the same thing, albeit on a smaller scale, because there are fewer of them. But yeah, as Greene marches out on the first leg of the Nathaniel Greene marches out on the first leg, there's a skirmish that takes place. But he recognizes our primary mission is to get food, supplies, wagons, you name it, so that we can get them back to the army, not to look for a fight. The fighting can come later, which is really interesting when you compare it to the British when they send two brigades, basically a full division, to capture Anthony Wayne and his band of 300 fellows in New Jersey. And the British, they're there. The accounts tell us this. They are looking, and I'm quoting, to have a slap at Mr. Wayne. And what do they do after penetrating, say 6 miles, 10 miles? They stop and they start foraging. They don't seek combat. So they've got this pattern of operations that works against them.
Now, how successful was the Grand Forage?
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
I was going to say the temptation would be to say, well, if we haven't heard of it, maybe it wasn't all that, it wasn't that grand. But then again, the Army lived to fight another day, didn't they?
It did. You know, it's, and as one of the things, I think for the soldiers who took part in it, it was probably just another foraging expedition. They didn't have the advantage that we do today of being able to stand back and look at the broader patterns that were taking place and understand the broader rhythms of the war and of the campaign and how they actually fit in. It's really advantageous when you've got this granular view that many of them would have had. But our ability now, mine as a historian, to be able to stand back and read far more records than any of them could have ever looked at, really allows me to place that into its much larger context. And I would like to hope that we're able to chat with a few of them to let them know just how important their contributions were to the success of the Army. I don't have, or we don't have, because a lot of records have been destroyed, lost, you name it, the full numbers. The best numbers the most complete numbers that we have come from Light Horse Harry Lee's troop of dragoons, Light Dragoons operating in Delaware and northeastern Maryland. I was able to find the account book that listed every farmer that he visited, all the property that he impressed, you name it, and all the valuations. It was fantastic. Here I was in my late 50s, and I'm doing a happy dance.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that many, if any, historians have ever made use of this account book, but boy, what a discovery. And one of the things that, you know, I won't go over the numbers, but one of the things that really touched me was the names of some of the wagon drivers. Some of them were enslaved, and so you had names. There were names like Negro Joseph, Negro Sam, Negro Cuff, and that adds to the complexity of the American story. It's not a story of good guys, bad guys, black and white. There are so many shades of gray in history, and that's what really makes it fascinating and human. And so here are the unfree in service for a cause of essentially white political freedom.
Yeah.
And so that really adds to the complexity of the story, and I think really says a lot about who we are as a people. It teaches us a lot more about who and what and why and how we are because of who and what and why and how we were.
Yeah. I think it humbles us. It should humble us to think about the ordinary people doing what they had to do. I remember reading years ago that the average age of the Continental soldiers was 16 or something. These were not, for the most part, except for the officers, the average soldiers were young guys, and this was their first war, and they had to learn as they went.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you've got, if you look at the number of times that enlistments ran out, there were actually three Continental armies, and most of these soldiers sign up for a year, sometimes a little bit less. The first 2 years of the war, there's this incredible rage for military service, and like a lot of young men and women, it's an adventure. They want to get out, get away from mom and dad, set themselves up, you name it. Every soldier's motives for enlisting are as particular to him and her as there are the soldiers. After a while, though, word gets out. It's like, wow, this war stuff really isn't fun.
Yeah, this is hard.
We don't get paid very well. Yeah, very often. And so it becomes, in a lot of cases, the rank and file of the Continental Army becomes society's less desirables, become those who are desperate, those who are warned out of their communities because they're seen as troublemakers, you name it. And so it becomes an army of, in many cases, the middle class for the officers, sometimes the gentry, in the case of folks like Lee and Washington. Mm-hmm. For the common soldiers, basically what we would consider lower middle class, even lower class, economically straitened,
right,
looking for opportunity.
We need to remember that. We need to remember that that people didn't all march out with banners flying and drums rattling and everybody had a great time, and then the British quit and we won. That it was a long, hard struggle, that there were great deprivations and sacrifices, and that the soldiers never got paid on time. The officers threatened to mutiny more than one time because they said, what good is it to be an officer if you can't even get paid, and so forth. And Washington, there's another thing that you mentioned here, and we're almost out of time, so I know we can't get into it a lot, but you talk about there were officers that made mistakes, but Washington rehabilitated them. You know, he gave them another chance because he realized often that's how you learn, is you survive your mistakes.
Absolutely. And everybody is learning. The Americans, the Continentals, and the militia, these are guys who are learning on the job.
Yeah.
Warfare is incredibly complex. They're going to the school of hard knocks in a very real way.
It is an extraordinary story, and so worth our taking time, not just at the 4th of July, but certainly now, but throughout the year to learn about these people who sacrificed for a concept that was alien to most of them, and some who would never get to enjoy it in their lifetime. And yet there they were. And this is a fascinating book, and I'm just so tickled that you made time to talk to me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for asking.
We have been enjoying the company of Rick Herrera, who is the author of Feeding Washington's Army, Surviving the Valley Forge Winter of 1778, from the University of North Carolina Press. You can check out their website, uncpress.org. Rick, do you have...
If you Google me, you'll be able to find me.
Okay.
Hey, thank you very much, and thanks for taking time. I wish you all the best.
Our guest again today, Ricardo Herrera, Rick Herrera, the author of Feeding Washington's Army, Surviving the Valley Forge Winter of 1778, which is really the story of the Grand Forage of 78, from the University of North Carolina Press. Thanks so much for joining us. We extended our celebration of Independence Day to another weekend because of the opportunity to talk to Rick, and we are so glad that he was able to be with us. I hope that you have had a wonderful celebration of America's independence once again, and we'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.